Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Our friend and fellow Chappahillean, Louis Rubin, died a few years ago. And at that time, some of us learned, some people for the first time, how important he was across the country as a teacher, as an editor, publisher, scholar, definer and promoter of Southern literature, mentor of some of our favorite writers. And one of his close colleagues, Shannon Ravenel, with him, the co-founder of Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill, I got her to agree to come in and talk to us.
Wasn't
about
hard.
This. Shannon Ravenel, thanks. I know you loved this man a lot, but there must be some tales that you can tell now that you couldn't tell before.
I don't know, DG. I did love him a lot. I do. It feels like, you know, it feels like years, and it was only, what, 10 days ago, 11 days ago that he died. We were all ready for it. He was ready for it. But it comes as a real blow not to have him there to, you know, go run by and check out, you know, should I do this? Should I do that? Which all of his students have done over the decades. Mm. He kept up with all of his students by letter, by phone. He was a remarkable guy. And that was in addition to having written and published more than 50 books, having started the Southern Review, having gathered the fugitives one more time before they all died, having founded the Fellowship of Southern Writers, not to mention Algonquin Books. He achieved so much in his life that it's almost hard to believe.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, because he'd been retired for a while, I guess, notwithstanding the continuing expression of appreciation to Louis and to you as well, from writers, our favorite writers whom we are keeping up with, Lee Smith, Jill McCorkle, Clyde Edgerton, just to name
a few,
leaving out many great writers, but those folks who are our contemporaries that Louis mentored, you all mentored. It's not fair to say Louis was behind the scenes because, as you say, he wrote a lot, but there are a lot of people in Chapel Hill who don't.
Don't really know. Well, he never really retired. I mean, I think he was writing right up until the very last. And the last thing he wrote was a letter to all of us who had gotten in touch with him when we heard he was sick. And he hadn't been able to get back in touch with every single person. So he wrote a letter to all of us, printed it up, and mailed it out. And I don't know how many he mailed, but it was a brilliant.
And what did he say?
He just said, you know, I've been going through some horrible medical things, and it's been a bore, and kept me from doing what I really want to do, which is to get in touch with each and every single one of you in person. But I just cannot. My fingers don't work the keys so well. On the computer, Robert Rubin, my son, has, you know, greatly helped me getting this letter out. And I just wanted to say hello again and, you know, please keep in touch. And if you're in the neighborhood, come by. And he meant it. He really did love, right up until the very end, he loved having visitors. He was at Galloway Ridge, for the last 10 years with his wife, Eva. And that's where he died, and that's where he, you know, was being helped by the skilled nursing. And I saw him a week before he died, and he was still, he had such a great sense of humor. I wanted to take him something, and I thought, what can I take him? And I had on my desk something that was on my father's desk, and that I inherited, and it was a medallion that celebrated, Louis and I both from Charleston, so this made a little bit of sense, and it was a medallion that celebrated the tricentennial. And the tricentennial was in 1970, and, you know, Charleston apparently was founded in 1670. So I took it to him, and I gave it to him, and he undid the box, and he looked at it, and he said, he said, so your dad had this on his desk. And I said, yes. And he said it was a good luck charm. And he said, when did your dad die? And I had to think a minute. And I said, oh, 1972. And he said, didn't do him much.
And he was, well, I love that I wanted to go back in time, but now I love this recent stuff. And one of the things that Louis Rubin's friend said is that, he was deaf.
He couldn't, terribly deaf, always. This was not just in old age.
So this made conversations interesting and sometimes comical, like this one was. But and when he sounded gruff to people who didn't know him as well as you all did. So he said that in a gruff way. He said thing, and he said, "Rah, rah, rah, didn't do him much good.
Well, he, I guess because he was deaf, I met him when he was about 35, I guess.
Tell us the story of your...
He was the brand new English professor at Hollins College, which is now known as Hollins University, and this was in 1957. I was a sophomore when he came, and it was the day you registered for courses. And I went up to his table because he was teaching American literature, which I wanted to take. And I think we all wore name tags the first few days. And he noticed that my name was one that was common in his hometown, Charleston. And he said, "Oh, you must be from Charleston." And I said, "I am." And he said, "So am I." And it turned out that my dad and his aunt were dear friends. And that I had read his uncle's columns in the Charleston paper for years. He was known as the Strong Cigar. And Lewis and I became friends from that moment on. And I think he was 30, in his mid to late 30s.
Well,
he was already deaf.
He
was, yeah.
Saw him as a, 80-plus-year-old guy surrounded by beautiful women at baseball games, because his former students and mentorees loved to do all kinds of things. And I said, what's this guy's secret? What's his secret? So was part of it, a young male faculty member at a woman's college, there are all sorts of challenges. Yeah. Was Lewis sort of drawn? We're all drawn to him because he was good looking?
It was never that way at all. And it was interesting because there was such a person on the Hollins campus. And Lewis was horrified by this person who, was married but dated co-eds. And Lewis was shocked and horrified by it and talked to him about it many times. But no, Lewis was always, even at 37, a father figure. Mm. He was a person that you went to for advice a lot. I think all of us, what's happening now that Lewis has died is all of us are getting in touch with each other. And I am realizing how very many former students he was still in touch with on a regular basis. It's amazing. And he didn't do it on the phone because phones were horrible for his hearing. He wrote long letters.
He was early problems with hearing.
Oh, yeah.
And so drove him into communicating.
Yeah, his métier was the word, was the typed word and then the computerized word. And he did a lot of emails later in life. I mean, in his late 70s and 80s, he got onto the computer and did emails. But really, there must be several, 100,000s of letters, long letters from Lewis. That he sent to students, former students.
I'm getting off topic. I'm so sorry,
okay.
Shannon. But when I've heard these powerful letters, even rejection letters, you've read rejection letters in which he turns down books, but goes on for pages and pages telling the guy why, encouraging.
What to look at in his own work and be encouraged about. He was very gentle in pushing people in directions. Jill has said many times that I think Lee said the same thing, that they felt that they had to do big things before they could be real writers. And I think Lee puts it that she should wear a black turtleneck sweater and go to Paris. And Lewis was very intent on making them understand that what they knew from their childhoods on was what was important for them to write about. And this was something that was quite different in writing courses. Writing teachers, I had two different writing teachers at Hollins. I thought I might be a writer. It turns out I really wasn't meant to be a writer. But the other one was very different from that. He had no interest in encouraging you to search your childhood memories, but he just didn't. But that was Lewis. Lewis made a really strong point with all writers to write what you know. And I think that's turned out to be very valuable advice for many, many writers who studied with him or worked with him or were edited by him.
We're visiting with Shannon Ravenel. We're talking about the late Louis Rubin, one of our Chapel Hill neighbors who died a few weeks ago. Shannon Ravenel and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Shannon Ravenel, who, along with the late Louis Rubin, co-founded Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. Shannon and Louis Rubin were great friends as well as colleagues in lots of enterprises. And Shannon, before the break, we were talking about the way he communicated with letters. And I wanted to ask because I'm so excited about what I've heard about these letters, which speak to me, is what I would love to hear from an editor if I were trying to write. And you say there are thousands of these letters around, but are you going to collect? We're going to collect them and publish them?
What's happened is that so many people have gotten in touch with each other since Louis's death. And one of these women is named Sudie Victor, and she lives in Maine, and she was from Chicago. She's not Southern at all, but she was one of Louis's former students who was greatly helped by him. And she wrote me and said that when she graduated from Hollins and decided to move to New York and go out on her own, leaving home, she was very rocky and shaky at the beginning. And Louis understood that and wrote her on a nearly daily basis, which is pretty amazing. This is while he was teaching at Hollins and had, a big load of work, not to mention his own writing and all the other things that he was involved in. And I imagine that there are many, many of those letters around. He certainly wrote me lots of them. So, yes, we have begun. It's only been 11 days, but we've already started talking.
Yeah,
and I have started talking, and we hope to get a group, and Lucinda McKeithen, hope to get a group of us together to talk about the possibilities of a book of letters.
Great. Oh, no, I'm real excited about that. I want to follow that. Will you keep us kind of in the loop about...
Yes. We're all sort of... coming up with ideas every which way, and want to also, of course, involve Robert Rubin, Louis's wonderful son, who's also a fabulous writer and has been with him at his side during his illness.
Well, what we were talking about were the letters from a writing coach and mentor and editor to people whose work was not ready yet. Either was not ready, but so you're a special case because he had to tell you that he didn't think you were going to make it as a writer. How did he do that?
Well, I was sort of interested in writing. I had edited the yearbook, I guess, at my prep school, and I guess I also edited the literary magazine. So I knew I was interested in words and writing and stuff, and I took his creative writing workshops every year that I could. They always met in his house in the basement.
So you're taking his writing course.
At
this point, you're still thinking, I might be a writer.
And I was writing short stories and poems. But I realized at this young age that I really enjoyed the criticism that we did of each other's work, that I really liked sort of picking apart other people's work and figuring out why some parts were good and some parts weren't. And Louis obviously noticed this as well. And he told me one day, he said, I guess I was near the end of my third year at Hollins, and I was running for a student government office, House Board President. And Louis said, Shannon, on your resume, he said, of course, I think you should go to New York and go into publishing, New York or Boston. And he said, I can help you. I have lots of contacts. I can write letters for you. You should definitely do it. And I don't know, you've probably heard this, DG, but I always remember that I had seen a very, very charming movie about a young, it was called The Best of Everything, and it was based on a novel, I think, by Rona Jaffe. And it was about a young woman who went to New York, got a job in a publishing house, discovered a handsome and highly talented young writer whose book she managed to get them to buy, and it was a bestseller, and they got married. And I thought,
not a bad plan.
Louis Society sounds pretty good to me. So I said, yeah, I think I will try to do that, Louis. And he said, But he said, really and truly, on your resume, and I don't even know if I knew what a resume was, but I said, okay, on my resume, yeah. He said, I don't think president of House Board would mean nearly as much as editor of the literary magazine. And I said, oh, but Lewis, I said, you know, there are points on those things, and I can only have so many points, and the House Board carries 10, and so does the magazine, and I can only have 10. So, no, I'll do the House Board. I'll run for House Board president. And he said, you're an ass, Shannon.
Did he really say that?
Yes, he did. He said, you don't know what you're talking about. Give it some thought, Shannon. But I didn't pay any attention to him, and I went right ahead and ran for House Board president. Meanwhile, Lewis, understanding that I was a young idiot, went and had the point system changed so that I could also
could do both.
Edit the literary magazine.
And you did.
And I did. It's called Cargoes. And much to my shame, I published one of my own bad poems in it. But I was young and stupid.
Well, this is a whole other thing, but the editor needs to share well, something bad or good in order to be
well, you know.
Well, just to so that the folks who read the magazine can maybe identify with who it is.
But I mean, it was that he was not gonna leave it alone. That was what was so interesting, that he was not gonna let me, be silly, be stupid.
Did he ever tell you that you weren't meant for writing?
No, never. He did not. But he did not really push me toward that. And he did other people. I could see it, you know, in the
that
workshop.
That you could see that, not that he was discouraging you, but that he wasn't encouraging you.
No, he was not. I mean, he was not excited. I guess that's what I saw. And I myself was very excited about the idea of understanding what was making something good and what was making something bad. Not my own, but other people's.
I think
he saw that.
Well, you point out something that I think confirmed this or comment on this, that Lewis didn't have wasn't arrogant in the sense of being willing to tell people that they were bad. He was only willing to say, this doesn't ring right with me for
whatever
the purposes that we have. And that I love when you read the rejection letter on another radio program the other day, in which he turned down an author's book, told him in great detail why it wasn't working for him, and then he said, I think you should share, others may have a different reaction, I really encourage you to share this with other
publishers.
Right. And if they don't bite, come back and we can discuss a contract for another book.
Amazing. I mean, it was amazing that he had that much empathy, and he obviously had seen something. That's a wonderful letter. I'm so glad I found it. I found it in my files. All of my Algonquin files are in the library.
What do you mean in the library? In the Southern Historical or in the North Carolina?
No, they're in the UNC archives.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Yeah,
all the Algonquin papers are there. And when I left the office.
Well, I'm sorry. That's a surprise. That's something to celebrate. So
yes,
that
it
all
is.
Of these, we're talking about collections of the letters. Some of these letters will
some
be in those.
Some of the letters will be there. Yeah, some of them. But a lot of people, I mean, Sudi Victor, for instance, has saved every single letter. And I'm sure other, I wish I had, I didn't. But she did, and she said they meant so much to her that she, you know, is glad she still has them. At any rate, he didn't say you shouldn't be a writer, but he said, I really do think you might have a career in publishing.
That was good. That worked out to be good for both of you, and we're going to talk about that later on after we take a short break. Okay. I'm visiting with Shannon Revenell, who was the co-founder of Algonquin Books, with the late Lewis Rubin. We'll continue our conversation about him after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. We're celebrating the life of Lewis Rubin, and Shannon Revenell, who was with him, the co-founder of Algonquin Books, is telling us great stories about Lewis Rubin. Shannon, you are, along with Lewis, celebrated as editor and mentor of our great and favorite writers. And so what... When you edit and when you mentor, do you try to do it like Lewis did it, or do you have your own style, or how do you mix the blend of your different, maybe your different approaches?
One thing I learned from Lewis, having been his writing student, was that it didn't help to be completely negative, ever. And that you be very careful of writers' feelings, because what they write is so close to their hearts that you really must be careful.
Well, how do you deal with that when it's really bad?
Well, what you do is you first talk about what's good, and then you talk about what's not working, and then you talk about what might make a difference. But I don't know whether I think I learned it from Lewis. I'm sure I did. But that my first, if I'm working with somebody whose book we will publish, but it isn't quite ready and it's not quite right and needs probably another draft or two, I just begin by saying, you know, I think this can be really good. And they get the message right away.
That you're partners rather than you're trying to whip something, make them change something they love.
It's like, well, I mean, I think I've said this probably in the past. I've compared helping somebody with their novel to babysitting their child. It's just, you know, it's something that's very precious, and you don't criticize the child. You just suggest that maybe there are things that the child needs some help with. The baby as metaphor for book has served me well.
And did that come from Lewis?
Not the very words. I mean, he never talked about it, this being as precious to somebody as a baby would be. But I think I got the idea from Lewis that you don't ramrod suggestions and down somebody's throat from the very beginning. You make sure that they understand that you see some promise.
I told you before we got started that I've been fiddling with Thomas Wolfe.
Yeah.
And so in that connection, reading about his relationship with his editor, which was both from one side very productive, but from another side, their relationship was not
Maxwell
as you
Parrish,
it was not as you're describing the relationship you
No,
had
he
with.
Was much tougher, I think, Maxwell Parrish. I've read the book of, isn't there a book of their letters? I think there is. I think I have it, and I read it years ago. Lewis was very interested in Thomas Wolfe, and in fact, when I was at the end of my second year, he suggested I do an independent study over the summer for credit, and he assigned me several books, but the lead book was Look Homeward, Angel, and they were all, I think all four of the books were books of, likes. Look Homeward, Angel, they were books of self-discovery, novels of self-discovery.
All Southern writers?
William Styron was one, and Thomas Wolfe, and I think maybe Eudora Welty. Yeah, I think they probably were all Southern.
And young people finding themselves
self-discovery. So. I mean, books that were early in the career of the writer and that delved into the upbringing and what it meant to their sense of life.
So Wolfe was important
to him.
To him,
very.
And I want.
I think he's credited with having put Wolfe on the map. I believe
of returning him to
returning him to the map. Well, what if, he is given credit for having understood that Southern literature as a whole was not being respected or taken seriously as a specific category of writing, and Wolfe was just one of those, I think, and he was very, very interested in making sure that Southern literature got its due, and I think he started with Thomas Wolfe as somebody who had been, you know, highly regarded, but then sort of forgotten.
Well, Lewis Rubin did something that you hesitated to do when I've confronted you before. That is to come up with a sort of a theory of why Southern writing during the time that Lewis was defining Southern writing had a definition to it that you could talk about why it was special and different from other writing in other regions. whereas you've been careful to say it's kind of hard.
Well,
that's
okay,
kind of hard to do.
Let's talk about then and now.
Okay.
Okay, because I think Lewis would, I don't want to put words in Lewis's mouth, Lord knows, and I should go back and read his books, his very famous books on Southern literature. I would say that in that era, the era of Thomas Wolfe and Faulkner, et cetera, that there was not much migration out of the South by these writers. Now, Thomas mm-hmm. Wolfe did go and live in New York, but what they wrote about was a rather more isolated region than what is the South now. When I was working on news stories from the South,
this is the collection of Southern writers.
Of contemporary Southern stories, or stories set in the South, I had come to believe that regionality was not as reliable as it had been in the earlier times, because people were moving around much more. And they were moving into the South as well as out of the South. And so when I chose the stories for each annual collection, which were drawn from literary magazines that year, I specified only that they had to be set in what we called American South. And we actually had the states all set out.
Mm-hmm.
And those states, in fact, are on the medallion that the Fellowship of Southern Writers get when they are included in the organization. They get a medallion and it has those Southern states on them. Don't ask me what they are.
I'm not going to ask
Texas
you what they are.
Texas is in there.
But there was a difference in the sense that you're not, I don't want to, avoiding the question by saying we're going to take stories, whether they're Southern or not, if they're set in the South.
Yeah,
and Lewis was willing to say, here's why Southern writing is distinct from writing in other writing.
And why he said he was willing to say Southern writers, as I was not. And I think, of course, he was completely right. And the fact that the fugitives were called the fugitives and the agrarians and so forth, I mean, it was a different era that he was studying and presenting to the world as a regional creative art that was slightly different from the rest of American literature at the time.
Yeah, all of this in the transformation, because I would want to rush to say Lewis was a defender of the South and our culture and our writers and all of that. But and so I would say Algonquin Books, which you all founded, was founded to serve Southern writers, but I was wrong about that.
No, never. I mean, I think he was I don't think he meant that we would publish only Southern writers. I'm certain of that. Because we didn't, even from the very beginning. We had writers from all over the place. I think what his main reason, or the one he gave me when he asked me if I would think about joining him in the effort, was that he wanted a publishing company that was accessible to writers who did not have connections in the publishing industry in New York City or live very far from New York and just didn't have contacts. He wanted to establish a place that was accessible. That was his word. And he didn't say to Southern writers. He just said to writers without connections to the publisher.
Well, Shannon, you were there at the beginning. What was the driving force? Was this to make some money?
No.
We know that he was not, it showed hardly ever any signs of egotism, but was it to say, look, I've been helping all these writers all this time. I'd like to have some of my mentees' work published where I can see it and share it with other people? What was motivating him?
I know what he told me. He told me that he'd been to a meeting of the MLA, the Modern Language Association, in Washington, D.C. at the end of December 1981. And he always took trains. He hated flying and he loved trains. And he, on the train trip back to Chapel Hill, from Washington, he thought about how often he had heard at these meetings, which are of professors of English literature. I believe that's what the Modern Language Association is. How their students were having such, their very, very talented writing students were having a very difficult time making any kind of contact with anybody in New York who could help them find their way to publishing their books. And Lewis thought about that a lot hard on the way home, he said. And when he got home, he thought about it some more, and he sat down and wrote me a description of what he wanted to do in the process of asking me if I would like to join him in trying to do it. And he said, I want to show the world that a traditional literary for-profit publishing company can exist and succeed outside of New York City, and that it can be accessible to starting out writers, whether they're young or old. In fact, our first book was by someone who wasn't very young. I think he was kind of discouraged about the business of how important it had become to have an agent to, you know, help you land a publishing contract. And I think accessibility really was his point.
Well, what did you all know about the business of publishing?
Not a lot. I mean, I had worked for, I went to work in publishing in 1960, and this was 81.
But you weren't on the business side, were
no,
you?
No, I was on the editorial side. I was on the secretarial side for a long time, but always in an editorial department. No, I knew nothing about the business side. I really didn't. And he did. He knew more than I did. But Lewis was not very interested in money. We collected, as I remember, DG, Lewis and I each threw in $5,000. We found, I don't know, six or seven very generous people who were interested in this idea and were willing to be on the board, and they donated. And I think the amount we had when we started, when we actually incorporated, we had a lawyer, we incorporated, was $50,000, which of course was not nearly enough. And it's really hard to make money in publishing, it's especially when you're just starting.
Well, did you all know that?
Yeah, we did know that, but didn't know it well.
But I mean, and you knew where to go to get your books printed. You knew
how to get them into
the trade, get them distributed.
He did all of that. The headquarters of this brand new publishing company, which was originally known as Brightleaf Books. Did you know that?
No, I didn't know
that.
And
the sales reps that he found, commissioned sales reps, told him that they didn't think it was a good idea to name a book publishing company after tobacco. And he said, you're right. I didn't even think of it. So he named it Algonquin because his father used to take trips to New York on a steamship that plied the waters between Charleston and New York.
Was the steamship named?
Named Algonquin. Named Algonquin. Where were we? Okay, we're talking about money. No, we did. But Lewis did all the hard work of figuring out who's going to print the books, who was going to sell the books, who was going to design the books, because he was here and I was living in St. Louis. So, of course, Lewis and I never had salaries either. And I was...
You were doing this on the side, sort of.
Well, yeah, I was doing it on the side, but became more and more of a job, you know, a big job as we moved along. And I was needed, you know, for meetings down here, so I would have to pay my own way to come back and forth. But it was so much fun. We were having a wonderful time. We were always desperate for money. We were. And we went the first book was published in the fall of 83. That was a book by a wonderful Kentucky writer who didn't write too many books, but this one was a collection of stories which was called Passing Through, Leon Driscoll. And it got a review on the front page of the Washington Post book review section on a Sunday, and it was just... Mm. And the reviewer said, I have to say, I've never heard of this author, and I've never heard of the publisher, but they're both damn good.
Well.
So that was wonderful, but it didn't make us any money.
Well. We need to take a quick break.
Yeah,
I want to come back.
Okay.
This is so, I hate to stop. I'm visiting with Shannon Ravenel. She's telling us the story of Lewis Rubin and the founding of Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. We'll take a quick break and be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Shannon Ravenel. And Shannon Ravenel is telling us about the founding of Algonquin Books. We're celebrating the life of Lewis Rubin, who passed away a few days ago. And we are celebrating and remembering. And I love the description of the business beginnings of Algonquin Books, in which you ran out of money pretty quick.
We ran out of money very fast. It got to the point where we kept going from, we had various sort of arrangements with printers, and also we had a quite amazing arrangement with a yearbook publisher in Texas. Oh my God. I mean, it's just, we would just, you know, whatever it took, we did it. And but in 1988, it had gotten so bad that UPS said they could no longer pick up our packages. We had no money to pay their bills. And so Lewis and I decided that we would have to put ourselves on the market and hope that somebody would be interested in buying the company and letting it stay in Chapel Hill, which was tricky. And we had a very good friend, a wonderful literary agent who represents many of our writers now, Liz Derensoff, who was in New York, had worked at Random House for many years. And we said, Liz, can you put it out there on the wire that Algonquin is up for sale? And she did. And we had two big dog suitors.
Why did they want you?
Because we had good books. I think we did. I mean, people were right. I think
so. They could say, oh, this is a talent and a groups of books that we can sell better than they can. Or,
well, Crown Publishers, I think you've heard this story, wanted, when we published Rainy, Clyde Edgerton's first book, they got in touch and said, we'd like your second book. So that, you know, we were being noticed, we were being reviewed, our books were being well reviewed. They weren't selling because we really didn't have the proper sales organization to do it, but we had a reputation that we'd made in 5 years. And so she put the word out. We had the two suitors. Lewis and I decided on one of them, and we went to New York to meet with them and their lawyers and so forth. All along this rough, rocky road, I had been talking to my husband's roommate at Yale, Peter Wortman, who started his own publishing company in New York years before we did. It was not a literary publishing house, but it was a very successful one, and he was very smart about money. So I began asking him for advice, money advice, and publicity advice, and so forth. Along the way, so we had this meeting with this big, major company. I'm not going to say who it was, but it's now the largest in America. And we were asked what salaries we wanted. I mean, they were drawing up the papers and stuff.
It was close.
Well, it was very close, yes, yes.
You were at the church and you're getting ready to go down the aisle.
And we didn't know what to say when they asked us for our salary requirements. So I said, Lewis, I'll go call Peter and ask him what we should ask for. And I called Peter and he said, you know, if they're interested like that, he said, I'd like to talk to y'all too. Don't sign anything.
Oh my gosh.
Come down to where I am and let's talk it over. Just talk about it. Talk about the salaries and so forth. He didn't say, you know. So we did. We went down. We went out to lunch at McDonald's, which was underneath his office building. And by the end of the day, we had decided not to go with the great big fancy company, but to go with Peter Wortman. And the reason was Peter had no concept of how to do what we were doing. And he wanted for his book group now has, I think, 8 imprints. That means 8 separate publishing companies. And we were, I think, the second one that he bought.
And the Shannon, we're out of time.
Oh,
but the,
man!
But the key thing was an understanding that you would stay in Chapel Hill.
Yes.
So, and that's worked for how many years now? For
30.
30 years.
Yeah.
That you've been.
Well, Peter's owned us. Peter also died, but he bought us in '89. So from '89 to now, and we stayed.
Well, it's a great story. And I'm glad we hadn't finished because there's so much more to talk about.
Well,
it makes me want to talk about
Lewis. I hope you can find a good place to cut it off. I mean, I was too long-winded on how.
No, you weren't. It was a great story, as were all the stories about Lewis, and we missed lots of them, but we got lots of them that I hadn't heard before.
There are a lot. I mean, there really are, and everybody has them, DG. You know, their own ones, because he did so much.
Well, let's...
You should hear the people at the Fellowship of Southern. I'm on the board now. I'm the only non-writer in the Fellowship of Southern Writers, and that's because Lewis.
We've got to stop. But for those who are listening, Shannon Ravenel and I will brainstorm how we can bring you more of Lewis Rubin. In the meantime, thank you, Shannon, for sharing all of this with us, and thanks to you for listening. This is D.G. Martin, Who's Talking, and I'll be back here before you know it.